Tonight on Arena, in TV, The Stolen Girl, Oklahoma City Bombing and Government Cheese, and new albums from Rhiannon Giddens and Justin Robinson, Julian Baker and Torres and Zoe Basha. And all of those very long titles will be up for review across TV and albums. Let us start with our TV reviews this evening. Apple TV 051551 as usual is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena and you can watch us if you're so inclined. rte.ie/arena. Now, TV reviews to start. Apple TV, give us Government Cheese, surrealist comedy set in 1969 and beyond in San Fernando Valley. It's the story of Hampton Chambers, played by David Oyelowo, newly released convict who wants to leave his criminal ways behind and reunite with his wife and two sons. But as Hampton pursues his dreams for a better life, he grapples with many obstacles, and moments of divine intervention are involved as well. Oklahoma City Bombing, American Terror, a new documentary that revisits the tragic bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building 30 years ago tomorrow, in fact, if my dates are correct. It features crime scene recreations and first-hand accounts from survivors, first responders and law enforcement. And there is a set of audio interviews with the perpetrator of that bombing, Timothy McVeigh. First up, however, we have Disney's The Stolen Girl, a psychological thriller based on the Alex Stahl novel The Playdate. Stars Irish actor Denise Goff as Eliza and Jim Sturgess as her husband Fred, whose lives are devastated when their daughter goes missing after a seemingly normal sleepover. Fast-moving, character-driven drama which the distraught Eliza desperately tries to track down her daughter. Jen Gannon and Declan Burke are with me in studio on this Friday evening. And let's start with that, The Stolen Girl. It kind of, The Stolen Girl, it's all there in the title. And it is the stuff of nightmares for any parent. And it's just another take. Well, or is it just another take on that, Jen?
This is the thing that is going to make parents sweat. So if you want to set up a kind of binge watch for yourself, a horror binge watch for yourself over the next couple of days, this is it. So as you said, it's adapted from the writer Alex Stahl's novel Playdate, and it stars our own Denise Goff. And I have to say, she was never commended enough for her role in Under the Banner of Heaven. I thought she was absolutely outstanding in that.
Great actor.
She plays Eliza, and Jim Sturgess is her husband Fred. They are parents to two children, including a daughter, Lucia. They're very middle-class, well-to-do people. She's cabin crew for a private plane company. He's a criminal lawyer, so they're very much living the high life, and they have the fancy house to prove it. But then one day, Lucia introduces Eliza to her new friend, Josie, and she gets to meet Josie's mum, Rebecca, played by Strikes Halliday Granger.
Let's have a listen to that moment, in fact. Very early on in the series, when the two little girls meet and the two mothers, I'm making inverted commas there in the air for those who aren't watching on rte.ie/arena. Here is the moment they meet.
Do you want a drink?
Yes, please.
Kombucha?
Yes, sure.
It's not quite champagne, but it costs nearly as much. We'll do champagne next time.
Great, I look forward to it.
Yeah, I do actually really miss travelling now that Josie's in school, you know? I mean, Jack's away all the time with work.
What does he do?
He works for a bank. Clients, deals, loans, too big to fail, all that.
Thank you.
Lucia mentioned your husband is a lawyer, right?
Oh, did she? Yeah, Fred, he's a criminal lawyer.
Oh, wow, that must be fascinating.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, for him, but it's not without its drawbacks.
It's quite a lot. Oh, Mummy, look, we're twins!
Oh, girls, you look amazing!
You're in it!
Sorry, do you mind not?
Oh, sorry.
Sorry, I'm just not comfortable with people taking pictures of my daughter without my permission.
I didn't even think. I'm sorry.
It's fine.
Well, look, she clearly wants to stay. So here's some sleep stuff. And this is Minky Mouse. She won't sleep without that.
Cute.
Well, thank you again. And if there is any problem, no matter what time, you just call me.
Yeah, of course.
Are you sure?
She's going to be fine.
Thank you so much. This is really sweet of you.
You're very welcome.
I'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah.
There you have it. I told a big fat lie, by the way. That is not their first meeting. That's their second meeting, Halliday Granger and Denise Goff as Rebecca and Eliza, respectively there. And on the second meeting, yeah, sure, she can stay overnight, Declan. But the music does go eerie when there's a picture going to be taken. So we know there's something up in this house.
Yes, I mean, how much foreshadowing can you jam into a single scene? Quite a lot. And yeah, that when that music makes that boom, that's the first sense that we get, other than the title of Stolen Child, that all is perhaps not well with the character of Rebecca. Yeah, I mean, I agree with Jen. This is the stuff of parents' nightmares. It's a relatively genteel version, but I think that's the point, because it is well to do, as you say. It's leafy Cheshire and so forth. This is what
she's a steward on a private plane.
She's not with an ordinary airline. The husband Fred is a criminal lawyer. These people should be insulated from the worst that, you know, the criminal world can throw at themselves. But the character of Rebecca is not a typical criminal. And we're not giving away too much in terms of spoilers, by the way. This all happens very quickly. When I say genteel, what we realise quite quickly is that the abduction of a young child, our first instinct, is the child going to be hurt? Yeah. Is the child going to be in danger? And we do, as viewers, know that the child is not in immediate danger from the character of Rebecca. She may be insane, and Holly Granger does terrific ways of portraying that, but the child is not in immediate danger, so we can all take a bit of a breath and step back.
Yeah, and I mean, I point out there they are having a sleepover about 2.5 minutes after they've met, type of thing, Jen. But part of this series is, It's full of throwing red herrings in, and you don't know, well, what's that actually about? Are we going to find something out about that? And if we do, please don't tell me.
It's a lot of what ifs, though, like on Denise Goff's part. So at the start and their very first meeting, Eliza is like the typical harried mom, and she's running late to
Denise Goff character.
Yeah, she's running late to pick up her daughter, and she's being admonished by the teacher. And Rebecca, a Holiday Granger, is there kind of covering for her. Yeah. So it creates this kind of sympathetic bond between them. And that's done really effortlessly, because it's a wink and a nod between mothers going, this teacher, what about her? And then there is, they chucked in this van driver in that moment. So he's honking his horn, trying to get Eliza's attention to move her car. So this all happens very quickly when they meet, and she just assumes, she seems like a nice mother. She, you know, my daughter is friends, you know, doesn't stop talking about her daughter. Okay, yeah, go on, you can have a play date. And then that's when, you know, when you see what transpires when the child goes missing, it's all about her guilt, about the what ifs. Why did she do that? Why didn't she talk to her?
And to be
more?
Fair, they keep saying, the question keeps coming up. Why did you let her stay with this stranger so quickly? But Declan, you will know, as from your crime writing side of your career, that you need the red herrings, and you need to plant something early on that, you know, the gun in Act One that'll go off in Act Two, to quote Chekhov. But, you know, you need to plant things in Episode One, and they do have to set things up so that there's a payoff further in. Without telling me what those payoffs are or aren't, did it work overall for you?
I did, and it did, because you're right, there is, you know, a shoal of red herrings here. There's virtually every scene, particularly in Episode 1 and 2, there's a twist, and that can be exhausting if it's not handled right. I think the performances are terrific.
Yeah, because you have the two women, you also have Ambika Maud,
as
the journalist, and this is amazing.
Astonishing.
I didn't believe in her role. She's a great actor. I didn't believe in the role. But that's
I like that she downplays everything, because I think there's so much there. There's a level of histrionics you could go with the Eliza character, with Denise Goff, even though she restrains herself too. But Ambika Maud's character is this nosy journalist, this very standard nosy journalist, but she dials it down completely and it makes it kind of believable.
You weren't fully convinced. You'll both agree to differ on that.
Not fully convinced, but I was very impressed by other characterizations, particularly the relationship between Eliza and Fred, Denise Goff.
Husband and wife,
think they're, because they both have, and again, not giving anything away, both have secrets to hide and so forth. So that relentless revelation, I usually find that a bit wearying. It wasn't. I think it's handled very well.
Okay, so stars from you overall on this one, Declan?
Stars is 3 out of 5. I don't think fans of the genre are going to see anything they haven't seen before, but I think they will be entertained as it proceeds.
And they will see it well acted. What are you saying overall, Jen?
I'm not saying that it's perfect, but I think in this era of very dodgy Netflix thrillers, we've strayed away from competency in television production, and this is very good and
it's
very
high-end,
well
isn't
done.
It? Yeah.
The editing, the sound sound design, the set, like the production design, all great. The acting goes without saying. Really strong performances. And I says, you know, it feels weird to be impressed by something that's quite nuts and bolts, but because we are living in a streaming age of shoddy workmanship, that's why The Stolen Girl seems strikingly good in this, you know, okay, field. So I'd say, I'll give it 3.5. You will binge it. I had to watch the full five. I had to watch them in a row.
And they are, they're kind of 45
yeah,
minutes of
their but you will. Yeah. It's gripping. It's compelling. It's what you want from a thriller.
Okay. What did you say? Streaming age of dodgy workmanship?
Shoddy workmanship.
Shoddy workmanship.
don't hold back. Yeah.
Okay. That was Stolen, which is available on Disney Plus. Let's move on to, you've seen this one, Declan, Oklahoma City bombing on Netflix, I beg your pardon. 30 years since Timothy McVeigh planted a bomb at the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in that city. Do you know what? Let's have a listen to quite early on in the documentary. This is all the news footage in what was just another ordinary day in Oklahoma City. And then all hell broke loose. And this was how the TV networks were reporting it.
I'm Tammy Payne in the TV9 newsroom. If you are anywhere downtown, you've probably heard it and felt it. An explosion of some kind downtown. Here's a live picture from Ranger 9. Jesse is in Chopper 9. Jesse, tell us what you're seeing from the air.
Tammy, you can see thick black smoke billowing from the federal court building downtown. We can see glass blown out of other downtown office buildings about 5 blocks away. Jenny, it looks like part of the building has been blown away. We'll have to bank around the other side.
It's the federal building, we're being told. My mic is open, is that correct? If you, let's try to keep my mic open if we can, and then I'll be able to talk with Jesse. If you are, if, as the chopper goes around the side of the federal building, look at that shot.
Holy
it is
cow.
Absolutely incredible. The side of the federal building has been blown off. Jesse?
About a third of the building has been blown away. And you can see this smoke and debris and fire on the ground, downtown on the ground. This is just devastating. And we are uncertain what caused the explosion at this time.
And there we have a clip from Oklahoma City Bombing, American Terror documentary on Netflix. And yes, indeed, April the 19th, 1995, which would be 30 years ago tomorrow. Declan, as I say, you've been watching this one. One of the things that struck me, you know, when you take on a topic like this, you have to be so careful about exploiting the lives of the people and the people, the loved ones of people who were lost, people who were injured. And yet you have to tell the facts of the story. They're very clever in that they take a couple of individuals from various walks of life, somebody from the television network, a person who was in the building, a doctor who was sent straight in and had to do this on the spot triage. I mean, yeah, it's harrowing stuff, but handled, I thought, well.
I agree. I think it was handled very well, Sean. The way it opens kind of sets the tone. It's actually a home movie that was shot that morning as
one of the women in the office.
In the federal office, building. Yeah. She's coming in.
Amy is her name, we get to know her.
She's about to buy her house that day. She's all excited and she's got all her friendly colleagues and all waving at the camera and so forth. Now, of course, we know what's coming. It's kind of horrible, but it does set the tone. In that idea of sensitivity that you're talking about, we're not just exploiting headlines and raking over these old tragedies for the sake of a documentary. From the clip, we heard that it's a lot of footage, news footage of the time. And then that spliced in with, as you say, some of the people who survived the day. That woman, Amy, for example, a woman called Claudette, who worked in a building down the street, but whose child was in the day centre.
There was a child care centre in the building.
Of the building. There is a guy called Carl Spengler, who was an emergency doctor who had just come off shift and rushes back in. Bob Ricks, the FBI agent who had overseen the Waco massacre 2 years previously, and Charlie Hanger, who's a highway patrolman who does a routine traffic stop an hour and a half after the event and just happens to pull a certain gentleman out of the car.
And what is amazing in the way they do that, it shows, yes, the police officers and those and the FBI officers who are investigating it, they were absolutely and totally thorough in what they were doing. But they did need certain just little bits of luck that led them to the right place and to Timothy McVeigh eventually at the right moment in time, like literally moment in time.
You say little bits of luck. I would say huge slices that they could not have possibly hoped for. That the idea, as you know, that you're doing a routine traffic stop because a car isn't shown a license plate and you ask a guy to step off and then he happens to be wearing a gun when he gets out of the car. So you say, this is not, have you got a license for that? No, I don't. I'm arresting you. What is your name? He gives a false name. He should get out of prison later that day, but because the bomb goes off,
everything gets slowed down. Yeah.
So he's still in jail in holding the next day when they run his name on a very archaic computer. So there's lots of different things like that. What's very impressive, Sean, the chaos, the absolute, they don't even know what caused the bomb. They think it might be a gas explosion and so forth. The way the first responders of all stripes rush in to start making sense of this is very impressively done.
And the other thing that, you know, that obviously the speculation starts very quickly and it speaks to a very contemporary situation as well. There's a thought about fundamentalist and some kind of Middle Eastern link is the way they were putting it back in 1995. There's talk about terrorism from there, but quite quickly they get to domestic terrorism and the connection with Waco, which had happened, was it 1 year or 2 years previously?
2 years previously. Yeah, on the same date. Absolutely, yeah. So yeah, I had the sense watching this, there's a number of shockwaves comes through this film, and the first one obviously is the blast impact, which is horrific, and 168 people died that day in the
film. 19 of them children.
Yeah, absolutely horrific. And then there's the sense that this is the heartland, this is Oklahoma.
Yeah.
This, you know, like leafy Cheshire, people should have been absolutely insulated from the possibility of Islamic terrorism. And then very quickly, and I think the first responders need to be applauded for it, they very quickly pivoted to the idea of domestic terrorism.
Yeah.
When that phrase was new, this idea of Timothy McVeigh, that was an unknown kind of concept.
And they follow him and find people who were involved with him, which if you don't know the story, it's well worth watching.
It absolutely is. Because Sean, the fourth shockwave I think that's blown through this film is that that was the first shot in a war that has continued over the last 30 years in America.
And crass to be maybe talking about Stars, a bit of documentary, but it's such an incredibly
Why not? I mean,
event.
It's terrific because it does all the technical stuff really good. It ties together the investigation, but it's incredibly moving as it weaves together all the people's personal stories. It's a 5 out of 5, I think.
5 out of 5 from Declan for Oklahoma City Bombing, American Terror, available on Netflix. Okay, Jen and Declan are staying with us. We'll be back with our third review, Government Cheese, whatever that is, after this break. All right, Declan Burke and Jen Gannon still with me in studio, and we'll have the third of our TV reviews at this point. Apple TV's Government Cheese. Surrealist comedy is how I talked about it at the very top of the programme. And certainly, Jen, as this starts out, there's a prologue in prison and then another prologue in prison. Tell us about the Hampton Court, the David Oyelowo character. He's not Hampton Court, he's Hampton Chambers. tell us about the character we meet across these two kind of prologues.
Yeah, so I mean, you're in this very broad landscape, like actually physically and metaphorically. You're in San Fernando Valley, California, 1969, and riots break out and they're in the prison.
This is in the prison,
And it's during a flood. You have this burglar, this petty fraudster, small time, you know, small fry criminal, Hampton Chambers, David Oyelowo, and he's released from prison. There is, like, something subsequently happens within this riot. There's an accident during it that is heartbreaking for Hampton, and it's his impetus to kind of endeavour to be a new person or, you know, but his old life, as per usual when you get out of prison, is dragging him down. It's there waiting to meet him. Like, he has invented, like, it's the American dream. Like, it's called Government Cheese for a reason. There is a moment where Hampton's wife, Historia, she's trying to explain to her sons when their father comes back who he was or, you know, who he is. He can create something out of nothing. He is creating this drill, this magic drill.
Self-sharpening bit, which I'm sure DIY enthusiasts would be very excited
and
to hear about.
You know, just like his mother, his mother managed to make these exceptional sandwiches out of nothing but plain white bread and government cheese. And it's about the myth making of America, the ability to reinvent yourself in the land of opportunity. He wants a slice of that, but he has to avoid the pitfalls and he has to have the courage to basically become someone else. And it's about, you know, when he returns returns home, his family life is very different. They've kind of been hijacked by the 60s,
yeah.
His family. So you have this, you know, one son, Einstein.
Let's go to Declan on that. The family that he goes back to, who have had to just continue on while he's been in prison. But yeah, things are far from perfect.
So he's, you know, he's getting out of prison with a pep in his step, and he's expecting the, you know, the big welcome home and so forth, and is to be slightly disappointed when he walks in, because his wife, Astoria, who's played by Simone Missick, I think she's terrific in this. Of course, she has heard one too many broken promises from Hampton. So she thinks, you know, you've had your chance. You're on your bike, sir. His older son, Harrison, has actually looked to Hampton's best friend, who was also in prison with them, a Native American, as a father figure, because he thinks Hampton is a completely lost cause. And then the younger son, Einstein, who is, as the name suggests, something of a genius and also an aspiring pole vaulter. He's glad to see his dad back, but he's not the kind of exceptionally affectionate kind of kid. So it's not really what Hampton had expected to be coming back.
Let's listen to the moment, one of the bonding moments between Hampton Chambers, played by David Oyelowo, and the son Einstein, played by Evan Ellison, and he's out in the garden. Is Einstein at this point doing a bit of pole vaulting? Pole vaulting practice.
I've got scholarship offers, Harvard and MIT.
I expected nothing less. So which one will you be attending?
Neither. College is for simpletons.
So you're just pole vaulting?
Like you're just making a drill?
No, this is not just a drill, son. This is a business. See, while the guys were shooting dice and doing dips on the monkey bars, I spent all my time in the machine shop. See, when you're machining on a large scale, the drill bits wear out quickly. It's just an inconvenient fact of a machinist's existence. Then it came to me while performing the most mundane and basic of life's tasks. By combining two ideas in a different configuration, I could create something new. Like a seaplane, a clock radio, a multi-purpose pocket knife. A drill sharpener within a drill.
Do you think the bit magician will live up to its name?
See, I've just got to tweak it. The calibration's off by a 16th of an inch.
The temperature can ruin the temper of both.
Yes. Yes, Einstein, my boy. See, with that mind of yours, you could be a doctor, a surgeon. More lucrative than a pole vaulting.
Not if pole vaulting is what you want to do. David Oliano there, and Evan Ellison as father and son, respectively, in that clip from Government Cheese. We were saying as we listened to that, Jen, that like it starts things, it starts the ball rolling on something, and then you kind of go, where did that idea go to? And then it starts another idea off.
Too many ideas. This cheese sandwich is not very satisfying, unfortunately, yeah. Because
sometimes a cheese sandwich should just have
enough
cheese in it.
That's what it should have. Don't overthink it, guys. But you can hear there with the Evan Ellison, with the Einstein character, he's Wes Anderson adjacent, that kind of eccentricity. And I think there's been a lot of talk about, like, after the passing of David Lynch, like, we need to have more surreal TV, or we need to have something with, you know, take risks or whatever. This is surreal. Like, Apple are pushing this as, this is your new surreal show. It is surreal in the sense of the Coen brothers. It's a yarn. And there's too many yarns.
The Coen brothers standard, though, I don't
know. No, I mean, you have this family that are on Hampton's tail, and he needs money to appease them, the Prevost brothers, and there's these epic, dumb, violent characters, and they're straight out of the Coen brothers playbook. Like, you feel that from them, but it's not in the same league. I mean, it looks, can I just say, this looks stunning. It looks absolutely beautiful, and you want to watch it, and you know that Paul Hunter, the showrunner, he is like cut his teeth in making music videos, and you can see that. It's beautiful to look at, but it's just not there. The story isn't there. Too much going on.
But was what I was waiting for. It's just not working. Too much going on, stars?
A solid three. But I do think if you want something really surreal, Boots Riley, it's a really underappreciated show. I'm a Virgo. Absolutely brilliant. Now that's bonkers. Yeah. Properly bonkers.
Properly bonkers. Declan, were you as disappointed as Jen was?
I would agree with everything Jen has said and was somehow not quite as disappointed. I think largely because I think the two lead performances were quite strong.
And
Simone Mizik
as the wife of Astoria.
And it's the kind of show that you'll just watch one episode after and then at the end you'll say, why did I watch all of those? But it has that quality. It's likeable without being outstanding.
Yeah, because I thought the prologues, there's a prologue at the beginning of every episode. I thought they might add up to something, but No.
Okay. Three stars.
That is A Government Cheese, which is available on Apple TV Plus. And the previous two we were speaking about with Jen Gannon and Declan Burke, The Stolen Girl, streamed on Disney Plus, and The Oklahoma City Bombing, American Terror, available on Netflix. And so to our Friday evening album reviews. Two heavy hitters in the indie world, Julian Baker and Torres, join forces on an album called Send a Prayer My Way. Baker, known for her solo work and her role in Boy Genius, finds a counterbalance in Torres, the stage name of Mackenzie Scott. Rising Irish star, Zoe Basha, whose debut album Gamble introduces a very versatile new voice, I would argue. She has Middle Eastern heritage, which informs her sound, and a background in classical performance. Basha's album, however, that only begins to tell you what it spans, which includes jazz, pop, experimental influences, all are wrapped around themes of identity loss and taking risks. With me in studio, Danny Kilmartin and Louise Bruton. But we're going to start with Rhiannon Giddens and Justin Robinson, who returned to their North Carolina roots with What Did the Blackbird Say to the Crow? Recorded outdoor on porches and plantations with all sorts of sound effects in the background. Here's a track called John Henry.
Still driving man, don't you see, Lordy? Still driving man, don't you see? Die with a hammer in his hand, Lordy. Die with a hammer in his hand.
John Henry, the title of that song from What Did the Blackbird Say to the Crow? A new album from Rhiannon Giddens and Justin Robinson. Louise Bruton and Danny Kilmartin, as I said, are our reviewers on this Friday evening. They're old pals, Rhiannon and Justin, from their Chocolate Drop days, isn't it? That's where, and their North Carolina roots, Louise?
Yeah, they go back a long way, both Grammy winners individually and with their former band. And while they have gone out travelling the world with various types of music, Giddens on violin and Robinson on banjo, they've never taken this kind of music out in the road, because this kind of music you have to go to someone's home to listen to. It's porch music. And there is just a real sense of the two of them having a great time. They're absolute pros. I can only assume all of this was done in one take. The way that they went around recording this house, this album was in three locations. One was a former plantation house called Mill Prong House. And then it was in the homes of their late mentor, the musician Joe Thompson, and then another musical hero, Etta Baker. So they would go to those homes with a couple of microphones, set it up, one each for them, and then another one for all of the nature that was surrounding them.
And and sometimes there's somebody there playing the bones or some kind of percussion instrument in the background as well, Danny.
And
there is that sense, there is a real sense. You hear the cicadas, you hear the birds, you hear lots of things, and you hear them saying, that was good, that worked, or, you know, okay, are we ready to start? It's designed okay, but it is this feeling of, it's just happening on the porch of a house.
That's it. I mean, in many ways, it's a very kind of transportive record. You know, they give us that. They offer the communal porch music. There's a lot of history to it. In many ways, it's like an old field recording or something, you know.
It has that feel of it.
Exactly, yeah.
And there's one particular, I think it was, is it Send a Prayer My Way, which was recorded in a very important location, an historical location, I think you had picked out. Am I looking at you now, Danny?
That's the Tyres and Julian Baker album. It's
Marching
Jaybird was recorded in the same North Carolina yard where Etta Baker, that Louise mentioned, had once performed herself.
Yeah, so I've jumped an album way too quickly. One of the things that struck me here, though, is the quality of the musicianship and the musical language, the musical communication between Rhiannon Giddens and Justin Robinson. I'll give you more to say on this one, Danny.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, they're really in sync throughout the whole album. That being said, it never sounds really, really rehearsed. It's very spontaneous. There's a real intimacy. You can tell they go back years, and that really comes through in the interplay that they have. Thankfully, then you have the ambient sounds of nature around them that kind of, they just add to the feel of the record, that it is being recorded on a porch and in all of these kind of historic locations throughout North Carolina.
Yeah, and if you're watching on Spotify, if you're looking at it on Spotify, the little videos that were playing along on my phone, at any rate, were them sitting on these porches with people around them watching and listening, as was the design for this music originally as well. Let's have a listen to Marching Jaybird. Marching Jaybird there from Rhiannon Giddens, recorded in the same North Carolina yard where their mentor, or where another mentor, Etta Baker, once performed. And I suppose that gives it a certain resonance in some ways. I think we were all saying, I asked both of you just before we started this, how many tracks are on this album? 18, I think, was the...
It's 18. I
mean, they're all brilliant in and of themselves. Is 18 pushing it a bit too far, Louise?
There is a slight element of indulgence here because it's something that they don't get to do that often. Mm. And I do really appreciate the way that they're trying to reclaim music as a thing that isn't a capitalist item while you can still buy this album for money. They use the technology that they wanted to use to create this. And I think it was just 5 people that were involved in the entire creation of this album. That was Gideon Robinson, the executive producer, mixing engineer and mastering engineer. And that's quite
refreshing. It wasn't a big label with loads of execs down.
Yeah, they weren't going to some swanky recording studio, and they weren't kind of like putting loads of money into it. I'm not sure... like much money was put into it, because it didn't have to be put into it.
Yeah.
So
I think the money that went into it is the skill of the two players.
Years and years of hard work.
Yeah.
But 18 tracks is a lot. I am not very well versed in a lot of this traditional music, but I am far more informed on the other side now of having listened to it.
Yeah, and Rhiannon Giddens does such amazing things with the music of that region, and she's done her railway line stuff, looking at how the railways informed music of the time. She's written operas using banjo. She's a very intelligent musician, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's something that this album is part of another project. Did it work overall for you, Danny?
Yeah, for me it did. I mean, like, to me, the record isn't really... it's not just about the past. It's about kind of using music to build a more rooted, connected presence, if that makes any sense. Yeah. And I just loved the interplay between the two of them. For me, it's 4.5 out of 5.
4.5. And what are you saying, stars wise?
4 for me. Their intention of learning music from Thompson was to carry on the history of black string music, and they've done exactly that.
Yeah, because it is about, as much as anything else, making an album and selling an album, it's about keeping this music alive. What did the Blackbird say to the Crow? Wonderful album title. Rhiannon Giddens and Justin Robinson. Let's move on to album number 2 then. Julian Baker and Torres, 2 indie singer-songwriters who've come together for this joint project. It's called Send a Prayer My Way. And here is, I think, the opening track. Is it Sugar in the Tank? I love you all the way, but I know how. Sugar in the Tank, not the opening track, the second track, in fact, on the album Send a Prayer My Way from Julian Baker and Torres. 2 very interesting artists here, Louise. Maybe give us a little bit of the background of both of them.
Yeah, it's hard to know how they found the time to make this album. They're both solo artists in their own right. Julian Baker is also part of Boy Genius, which is the super indie group with Lucy Dacus and Phoebe Bridgers. Mm. They played Ireland only last summer. Julian and Torres met in 2016, and they had this connection on a show that they were working on together. And 10 years in the making, they have come together to release this country album that they promised they would make back then. So they both come from a very staunch indie background.
Yeah.
But their commitment to the countryside of this is, you would swear this is the music that they make the entire time.
And, you know, I love your description of the album, if you will just indulge me in that, Danny.
Certainly, yeah. If you ever wondered what a Lucinda Williams album might sound like if it were made by two queer Southern punks in 2025,
this here is it. Is. But for all of that, it's more a Lucinda Williams album than it is anything subversive that might come from their political and backgrounds.
If you're focusing purely on the sonic element of the album, I would be inclined to agree with you.
Lyrically.
Absolutely. Like there's a touch of the Lucinda Williams, there's a touch of the Loretta Lynn, there's a little bit of the old drunken regret of a Townes Van Zandt in there as well, you know. But lyrically, what they discuss, you know, there's questions of faith, just sexuality, healing, trauma, it's all there, laid very, very bare. It goes back to the old, you know, three chords and the truth. It's their truth. It's a different truth, you know.
And I must say, in terms of the second track that I have here, Sylvia or Tuesday, which would you rather actually, Sylvia or Tuesday, Louise?
Well, if from the COVID times of phoning me at home to do album reviews, you know I have a number of dogs running around my house. So Sylvia is a love song to a dog that belongs to Torres.
So. Okay, so that is the one is the one that you will choose.
Every time your cheek goes unkissed, a day for me is a week for you.
There we go. Sylvia the dog. Bidding bye-bye to Sylvia the dog, Julian Baker and Torres from the album Send a Prayer My Way. And you were saying as we were listening to that, Louise, that this is something that happens at the Boy Genius gigs.
Yes.
Regarding phones and dogs.
Dog facts, more dog facts. So Sylvia is about a dog, but also at Boy Genius gigs, they request all of the audience to hold up any pictures that they have of their dogs so they can sing a love song to everybody's dogs.
And there is something slightly subversive, obviously, then in that the song Sylvia, because the presumption is you think, oh right, this is some woman in one or other of their lives, but no, it's not.
Yeah, you would believe it's a loved human, but it's a loved pet. And when you listen to it with that fact in mind, there's a great line where it says, a day for me is a week for you, which is very much a dog's life.
Dog ears are so different. And also it gives it it does when once you know that fact, you hear all the lyrics totally differently.
I think that's their gift as well, because the first time I listened to this album, I was like, it's hilarious. And then the second time I listened to it, I was just devastated with the swinging emotions that they have.
And you were saying, Danny, as we were listening there too, that in fact the song that we just listened to, Sylvia, is probably closer to what they do as solo performers than any other track on the album.
Yeah, I mean, taken at face value, it sounds the most kind of just closest to indie rock and something you'd be accustomed to from either one of them in their solo work or indeed with Julian's work with Boy Genius. So until you hear that little trace of pedal steel guitar come in, there's just enough there to, and the harmonies, of course, are very...
Oh, the harmonies are extraordinary, and on that track in particular, but across the whole album.
Straight out of the Dolly Parton playbook, like.
Yeah, and their two voices sit brilliantly together.
Gorgeous. Yeah.
Do you want more from them?
I'd go one more.
Yeah, you'd go one. No, I'm not tonight. I'm saying, do you want a second album?
I would love a second album from
Okay.
Third, fourth, one.
Don't be greedy. You get two tracks and that's it. Two tracks and the truth. So, stars from you on this one, Danny?
4.5 out of 5.
4.5?
5 from me. I think could be contender for the album of the year already.
I think Sylvia may be swaying you. Sylvia the dog may be swaying your judgment. But nevertheless, I'll take your 5. That is for Julian Baker and Torres, Send a Prayer My Way, album number 2. Let us move on then to album number 3. Irish artist we have here in Zoe Basha, Dublin-based, but French-American, of course I'm calling her Irish, French-American musician and composer. Debut album is called Gamble. Let's have a listen to a track called Love Is Teasing. You know this song, even though you think you don't.
Oh, love is teasing.
Love is teasing there from Zoe Basha and her new album, Gamble. And, you know, you listen to that track, Danny, and you think, all right, we have a traditional Irish a cappella singing here, and she's bringing her particular twist to it. You can't sum this album up with one, with any one track on it.
Not at all, no. I mean, like you said, you'd listen to that and you would straight away assume that it's going to be an Irish folk album, but throughout the 10 to 12 tracks that are on the album, you get Appalachian storytelling on it. There's some jazz phrasing. There's a little bit of blues there as well. Mm. It's a very versatile, very diverse album.
So many musical styles across the album, Louise. What is she singing about, or is it as varied as the styles of singing that she gives us?
It's very varied. She covers a lot of songs. Love's Teasing has been covered by the likes of...
Yeah, there's a couple of originals, but...
A lot of interpretations. Mm. Isabel Campbell, Dubliners, many, many versions, different lyrics, and she's taken a more kind of stripped-back version of it. She's also done a cover of Three Little Babes, which is more of a haunting, string-filled, drone-led song. Mm. Joanna Newsom has a cover out there as well. But her more original music, songs like Travel and Shoes, it sort of reflects her own nomadic lifestyle. Like you said, she's French-American background but lives in Dublin. When she felt her music career wasn't doing much, she went to work on a French timber yard. She moves around.
Yeah, and Magpie-like picks up musical influences and cultural influences along the way.
Even within the songs, she can go from a very kind of sedate blues songs to sort of a very upbeat ragtime song in just a flick of a verse to a chord.
Yeah, actually, there's a bit of a switch like that, I think, in the midst of the second track that I want to play, which is Dublin Street Corners.
Who are you fooling? Couldn't be me, cause I never let myself get ruined. Mon amour.
Who knew that around some Dublin Street corner there was a French alley? Because that's exactly what she does there. She literally turns a musical corner and it goes from what was a straightforward country sound in some ways with this kind of Appalachian fiddle happening above it. We could have had Rhiannon Giddens and Julian Baker involved in both of those tracks. And then that switch into that kind of French cafe sound. You made a lovely kind of comparison or a lovely metaphor or simile for what this album is.
Yeah, it's kind of like a patchwork quilt sewn together from every place that she's lived in. And it does show, I mean, like that song is probably the most emblematic of it throughout the album, the Appalachian strings, but also then French cafe sounds, the accent, the whole lot. And I think that's what's so great about the album is that she just manages to sew it all together through her voice and just being deft at performing all of these different styles.
And what Danny's saying there suggests that it does all come together, because that is the problem sometimes, Louise. If you have all of these multifarious influences, each song works on its own merits, but does it all come together into some kind of coherent album called Gamble, which she clearly thinks she was taking one, I guess.
It's an incredibly ambitious album, and the fact that it was produced entirely by Zoe herself is incredibly impressive. She's got a huge range of knowledge, a huge range of expertise in each of these genres, but at times I do feel like it's a bit of a whiplash of genres. I'm more in favour of the songs like What Dream Is This, which has sort of electronic undertones to it, which I feel just adds a very nice pace and contemporary twist to the song, but also her cover of One Morning in May, which is was made prolific by Texas Gladden. It's another a cappella track, and it just lets her voice
soar. You want to hear more from her and Stars on this?
Yeah, this is a debut, and it's impressive.
It's a good gamble.
Three and a half stars from me if it was just a little bit more finesse.
All right, and you, Danny?
Around solid four from me.
A solid four from Danny for Zoe Basha and Gamble. Before that, Louise Bruton and Danny Kilmartin speaking to us about Julian Baker and Torres and their album Send a Prayer My Way, and Rhiannon Giddens and Justin Robinson and their album What Did the Blackbird Say to the Crow? And that is our lot for this Friday evening. John Byrne was the broadcast coordinator. Mark Dwyer was on sound this evening. Liam Murphy was the researcher, and tonight's programme was produced by Keshi, who will be in the seat for the next week. I'm taking a little bit of time off around the Easter period. I have to get through all that chocolate and I need a week to do so. I will be back with you on the following, the Monday after Easter, if you know what I mean. Enjoy your Easter break, those of you who are getting one, and I will talk to you in a week's time. John Crean will be with you after the news.